Möchtest du anmoderieren? Soll ich
Alles
anmoderieren?
gut?
Alles gut, alles super.
Zum Grünen Engelturm. Ein Buchpodcast aus Ostenart. Mit Kaya und Sabrina.
Hallo Kaya.
Hallo Sabrina. Hallo Ted.
Hallo.
Hello and welcome to our special bonus episode of Zum Grünengelturm. We have a special guest today and welcome Ted Williams.
Thank you for having me.
It's nice to have you. Thank you for joining. And I think we don't have to explain to someone who's listening to our podcast who this is, because our podcast is dedicated to your really, really awesome books. We've collected a few questions from our listeners and from ourselves, and we want to talk about this a little bit. And my first question is, and now we have time to make some editing, I think so, because I think we have to play our podcast music to you before we ask you if you like it. Haben wir die überhaupt irgendwie dabei?
I think I have it.
You have it? Can we?
I don't know.
We don't know? We try.
Or you could play it for me afterwards, because I'll assume that I'll like it. You could hum it for me.
Yes, we could. But it's just really, I love it really, really much. So,
will I recognize it, or is it something?
No. Something, when making podcasts, you have to take care of the rights of the music.
Of course, yeah.
I have
so it was, there are platforms where you can choose from.
Right.
And we choose something we thought would match the atmosphere and the medieval some kind. And I'm still in love with this. Mm-hmm. And you pay for it, that right. You can use it for podcast or right. Something like that. You have it? Yes, there it is.
Yes.
On in this kind of orchestra, big soundscape. It's starting just a little slower, and now it's getting really great and big. And through all the instruments, through the violins and the what is the metal instruments?
Brass.
Yes.
Brass or the woodwinds. Woodwinds are the clarinets.
Yes.
And those brass are the trumpets.
The trumpets, posaunes, and all those things. You have just goes through all different groups of music.
Mm-hmm.
Music, English, not my English.
No. The different, we would say the different parts of the orchestra, yes. Or different sections of the orchestra.
Yeah. Yes.
Brass, woodwinds, strings, you know.
And we thought it matches from the atmosphere,
yeah.
So just we have a small intro, which is just a little slower and not the full orchestra,
mm-hmm.
Where someone tells an intro, which means Zum Grünengelturm, a book podcast from Ostenart,
right.
Kaya and Sabrina, and then we have this full song always at the end of the episode, and
very cool, but I like it. It's
like.
Good. It's good.
Okay. Both of them. Yes. So right now we are in part two of Stone of Farewell. So we're not so far in our story, but we have several questions about how you choose the titles of your chapters and the parts of your books. For example, in Dragonbone Chair, we have Simon Mooncalf. Then we have Simon Pilgrim and Simon Snowlock. Just, I have to think what it is in English, because I read it in English, I read it in German, we talk about it in German, so I have to.
And I have to think about it because I wrote it 35 years ago or so. So I have to try to remember this distant past.
Yes, but usually the chapter title, the titles of the parts in Dragonbone Chair are really self-explaining. But sometimes you have titles from your chapters where you can see at the first moment that this title refers to this part of the chapter. And sometimes, especially when you have chapters with a lot of different perspectives, it's a little bit more difficult to recognize the title of the chapter. But when you dive deep, you find every time a little tidbit of the chapter title in every perspective. That I think that was on purpose.
Generally, yes. One thing about the way that I write is that I do tend to be very architectural. And that means a lot of attention to detail, a lot of building up by putting one thing on top of another, and trying to make sure that everything works together. So yes, in most cases, I as I said, it's been a very long time. It might be difficult to remember why all these things happened. But in most cases, yes, I am usually trying to find a chapter title that, even if it's a line from one specific part of one character's section of the chapter, that it at least has some resonance with the rest of the chapter as well. It gives a general feeling about what might be happening.
You were inspired by Tolkien. I know since yesterday, I know you read them many times.
Yes.
Do you also read the Silmarillion or only the Grave Elves?
Oh, yeah, no. I've read huge amounts of Tolkien. The Silmarillion obviously came out very soon after he died, as I recall, or just before. And it was the number one on the birthday presents list that year for me. And of course, being the kind of reader of Tolkien I was, I had exhausted the appendices at the end of Return of the King, and you know, was ready to know more about all of these different issues and historical bits. And of course, one of the things that I loved about Middle Earth was the depth of the creation, or as Tolkien used to refer to it, sub-creation, because that was a religious issue for Tolkien, that humans never create, but we can sub-create. And so, yes, I was a big fan, very interested in the Silmarillion, and I was the kind of person that it was aimed at. I was not somebody who needed to read. I would have been happy to read another full story like The Lord of the Rings, but I was also very much somebody who wanted more history of the world and what he had been thinking about. And so then also over the years, I have read several of the volumes that Christopher Tolkien, his son, has published, not with, you know, absolute detail, every single word, but I've always been interested in the creative process of anything. As I think I mentioned to you at another point, my wife does fabric art, and that interests me. Her creative process is very interesting to me, even though it is quite different from what I do, but I'm very fascinated by that. So things like the Silmarillion, or even like Tolkien's collected letters, were of great interest to me because of that emphasis on where things come from, how things are put together and come to life. And it was also a very big influence on my later work when I became a writer myself.
Okay, back to memory, Sarah and Thorn. We have several questions about your characters and your figures in these books, because we are just at the beginning of our journey. So do you have favorite characters or characters you don't like? And depending to that, are there characters you would love to spend more time with? Or when you were sorry that you did not could spend more time with them? I can remember I was on a reading of you in I told about Ilva in 2006 in Münster, where you told it that you had a situation when you thought, oh, I could use this person, but the person died a book ago. So what to do now?
Right.
So it's just several people ask about what is your personal relationship to your characters?
Well, there are basically three kinds of characters that three types that are appealing to me. One is appealing simply because they are fun to write. And those are usually the characters who are interestingly unusual within the setting. A character like, say, Binnabik the troll, who obviously you have already met in this reading, and who comes in. He is one of the first characters that is from and Miriamel, what is the ordinary world, that their everyday world, which is, of course, very similar in many ways to, say, 13th century, 14th century Europe. It's not that different. You know, it is largely arranged around a central church, and it is a feudal system. And so in many ways, it is very, very similar. So Binnabik is one of the first characters who shows up, who is from quite a different background. And that was one of the things that I wanted to do with this story, was to move, especially Simon, from this world of familiar things, not just familiar to him, but familiar to the readers. And then as he goes out into the world, he begins to encounter other ways of thinking, other ways of doing. And in that way, it's rather similar to the journey that many of us make from childhood into adulthood. We go out into the world, we learn that maybe some of the things that we were taught were particular to our family or our place where we grew up. So I definitely enjoyed that, and I enjoyed using Binnabik as the first foil to this upbringing Simon had had. And of course, he also is, I think, is funny in a quiet way. He's very droll, and he has these, you know, words of wisdom, which are on the one hand very wise, but on the other hand, in part because of the translation, are amusing, you know. So that's the most obvious kind of character that is really fun to write. There are also characters that I enjoy writing because I am exploring certain personality types, including my own. So, for instance, one of the characters who is most like me in these books, who you have also already encountered, but who becomes even more important and common in the plot later on, is Prince Joshua, who I believe at this point has now started his own plot line, basically.
Yes, he's just going for Stone of Farewell.
Yes.
Wait.
Although I believe Joshua is, if I remember correctly, and I'm pretty sure I do, that he is one of those characters who you never see through his own internal dialogue, but you see him through other characters. And Joshua interests me because he embodies certain elements of my own personality and other people that I know and love in my family and elsewhere, who are extremely conflicted with moral issues, not in the sense that we want to do wrong, but in the sense that we're constantly worrying about what is right and which between these choices is the proper and best and kindest choice to make. And in fact, I believe, again, it's been a long time, but somewhere in the story, and it may be later than you are, this is not a spoiler, but Darnoth, who is the character who is most often the focal point when Joshua is on stage, so to say, Darnoth essentially says to him, you know, you cannot let yourself be paralyzed. There are decisions that you have to make that will cause some bad things to happen. And all you can do is choose which is the better of the two, but you cannot avoid choosing. And this is Joshua's main problem in terms of ruling or being a ruler, is he is really reluctant to put other people at risk on his behalf. And Darnoth is saying, no, you have to. You must do that. And in the end, this is not a giveaway either. I mean, Joshua does move more in that direction. He takes he's more willing to do that because he recognizes the desperation of their situation. And that actually, a lot of that is happening in the second book, in Stone of Farewell. So that's another character that I enjoy writing because it's a struggle that I understand very well and I'm interested in. In some of my other books, like the Otherland books, that there's a character who is one of the very main characters named Rini Sulawayo, who also embodies that particular, I must take care of everybody ethos that I inherited both by genetics and by environment from primarily my mother. And so it's an inner struggle that I'm fascinated by. And so I will use my chance to create characters sometimes as an example, not an example, as an opportunity to investigate my own issues and things that interest me. So that's the second kind. The third kind is somebody who you just find yourself either rooting for in the sense that you kind of just like them. And so you want to, as a writer, I want to put them in situations where I can let the readers enjoy them also. Or in a similar way, but very different characters also with the villains, that sometimes I want to create characters simply to shock and disturb the readers, because of course that's another texture that is very important, especially in a big story. You want, for lack of a better term or a subtler term, you want bad guys who are truly upsetting and frightening. And as a result, I love writing those, not because I like the characters, I despise them in who they would really be in the real world, but because it is me interacting with the audience in a very direct way. So you have not gotten to, I like Isgrimnir, for instance, very much. And he also becomes more common in the story as it goes on. But some of his interactions I can't talk about without giving away things later in the story. But there are some things I set up deliberately, you know, in the way that you would bring a surprise character on stage or something like that, you know, just because you know the audience will love it. And the same holds true. Sorry, go ahead.
No problem. Isgrimnir is one of Sabrina's favorite characters. It was just want to add that. Because he's really such a nice person with his humor, with his, I don't know what is the word in English, his Rumpeligkeit, his, I am here, I am the king. He's like a big bear.
Yeah, yes. He is not a subtle, he is a subtle character in his mind, in how he thinks about things. He is actually a very clever and sensible person that you would like to have running your country, you know, since he is the Duke of Rimmersgaard. But he is also somebody who wishes he could simply act directly. And we all understand that. And I know readers do. So as you get later into the book, he has opportunities to act more directly. And I that is deliberate on my part because I know there is a catharsis for the reader when that happens. They're like, finally, you know, is Grimnir gets to belt somebody or that kind of thing, you know, so that. That and the villains are very much things that I write because as a reader, I know that we still have this very old need to applaud the heroes and to hiss at the villains, you know, and to boo the villains. So to make that happen, you want to make those villains and heroes not unusually or impossibly wonderful or bad, but certainly you want to push the envelope in both cases to engage the readers. So those are my three favorite characters, three kinds of characters to write. Beyond that, I have a whole other level where I'm writing, which has to do with very, what I would call utilitarian needs, because in a sense, in books like these, and especially in long stories, the characters are not just people, but for me, they are tools. They are things that I use to tell the story. So I can also get tremendous satisfaction out of discovering that, like this character who I initially put in simply because they were interesting or whatever, but then something comes along and they prove to be very, very significant. And, you know, that I feel like, oh, I put that in there for a reason, even though I didn't know the reason at the time. So that's also kind of really interesting to start out with somebody that you don't have many expectations for, and then they kind of insert themselves further and further into the story. And there is one you've definitely met already, and I don't think I'm giving anything away at this point. No, because
I think you're talking about Hestan.
About
Hestan.
No, I'm actually talking about Cadrach.
Ah, okay.
You have met, and you know at this point that he is accompanying Miriamel as she has fled south, right? Because that's at the end of Dragonbone Chair. And it becomes an entire storyline in the second volume. But the thing about Cadrach, it's a very good example that when I was first writing the Dragonbone Chair, and if you remember, Cadrach's first appearance is when he basically pickpockets Simon at the fair. But he is also clearly a slightly strange, kind of dark, humored, morbid character who clearly has pain and dissatisfaction that he is dealing with. But I honestly, I try to treat each of my characters as though they are the star and hero of their own lives, even when they are only briefly there. So I did not think of Cadrach as a returning character. I just wanted him to be interesting and rounded when I introduced him. But then when I was still writing Dragonbone Chair and I got to Naglamund and I knew Miriamel was going to be fleeing from Naglamund with the idea of getting to her father and talking sense to him, which the reader, I think, could already sense, it could already tell at that point, it was probably not going to change the way things were going. I don't think that's surprising that probably when you read that, you went, I don't think you're going to suddenly tell him to turn around and he will. But I was literally trying to think, I cannot imagine even Miriamel, even headstrong Miriamel, setting off across country on her own. And so I want someone to go with her. But it can't be Simon because I already had plans for Simon. And, you know, there wasn't really anybody else that the readers had noticed. So I thought, you know, however, oh, Cadrach, he was an interesting character. I don't know why he would be there or why he would be involved, but I can imagine that he would be an interesting byplay between the very straightforward Miri and this kind of strange monk.
Especially knowing the way and the things that happened to Cadrach and the things that were revealed from Cadrach's history. This is really interesting to get to know because he has a very important part to play at the end.
Yeah.
So this is interesting to see how you develop your own world.
Yeah.
And comes to another question, maybe, how do you... Yes. When do you decide what happens to which character? So we heard about that a little bit yesterday, about your writing process. You could, mm-hmm. could you please sum it up again for our listeners to our podcast?
Well,
just in short.
Sure. One thing that I do that is maybe different from a lot of writers is that every day, because I write nearly every day before I sit down to actually begin typing on my keyboard, I spend several hours thinking about what I'm going to be working on that day, but also thinking of the larger picture because everything is interconnected. And as a result, I find that if I write things down and make too many notes, that they begin to become more real and they are harder to discard if they don't work, these ideas of what might happen. So I have, you know, all these many plot lines, you know, 20 plot lines and 20 or 30 character point of view and slightly conflicting timelines, which nevertheless have to be kept more or less in sync with each other. And it is very complicated. I think of it as weaving, essentially. I am weaving many strands together. If later on I realize I have done something tragically stupid, then I will find it very difficult to pull one thread out of that woven tapestry, to give it a very grandiose name. So as a result, I spend a lot of time before every working hour or day or whatever, working solely in my head and trying different possibilities and saying, okay, so today it's going to be so-and-so and so-and-so, I think, although it could also be so-and-so, but how would that change that? Well, anyway, even if I go with the original and it's so-and-so here, that information is going to have to eventually get to these characters, and that will change what these characters know and what they decide to do. But how would that information get to them? Would it be easier to bring it another way? So I am trying these things, and every now and then I will think, oh, yes, that makes sense. And then I'll realize, oh, except then that undercuts this other thing I wanted to do. So I will throw that one out. This is all in my head, and I will try another thing. And I will go through many, many, many different iterations of what possibly should be in this next scene, concentrating mostly on the connective tissue to other parts of the story. Then when I feel I have finally narrowed it down and I have said, yes, it will definitely be this person, definitely be that person, and I will, you know, decide it should be here because that would make sense based on where they were the last time. But on the other hand, maybe they should be over here because that's about an equal distance, but that is more useful for what I am doing. And that would also mean the information could be trickled to this other thing, you know. So there's a great deal of this kind of consideration. So by the time I sit down, I usually have the equivalent of an outline in my head of what I'm going to do that day. But I have to keep things alive and lively, otherwise I am just doing transcription. So I leave a lot of things with how that part is being told in terms of what the mood is, what other things might be going on in the background or intruding from the sides, you know, where I want people to have conversations in the midst of this business that I have to do that will give more insight into the characters or will be a break for the readers, you know. So if I feel there is a lot of exposition here, there is a lot of information being passed, I better find a way to make that interesting. For instance, in the Dragonbone Chair, I remember distinctly there is a part in Naglamund where Jozua and I don't remember if it's just Jozua or Jozua and Darenoth, but they're talking at some length about things that are just what we call in the business an information dump. They are things that the reader needs to know, but they're not the most exciting thing. So I went, well, this would be a good opportunity to have Isgrimnir as the focal point character so that he's not in the central conversation. So I don't have to concentrate as much and foreground the information so much that can be there. But meanwhile, Isgrimnir, as I recall correctly, is watching a spider building a web up in the corner. So it gives us a chance to have more of an insight into Isgrimnir. He's thinking about his family. He's thinking about the worries of the coming catastrophe. And he's also watching the progress of this spider. So it the reader may not, I hope, may not realize that they are having information shoveled into them and are also enjoying the chance to see Isgrimnir.
It's just the same like the two frogs story in Morgan with Morganis in
yes.
the Hayhold,
yeah.
when he's just telling Simon really important things about history and histories
yeah.
about Ostenaard, and this is something really important for the reader too.
I call it the history lessons or the
yeah, we have history lessons, geographic lessons, all those. Was religion, yes, was just different chapters that the reader gets to know different types and themes of the book and of your world building.
Yeah.
So that was.
And that's one of the reasons that you so often see youthful characters as the, you know, in the center of stories in fantasy or science fiction, because in both of those genre or subgenre, there is a great deal of the world that has to be explained, you know. So in old science fiction, you always have the young engineer, you know, in the Isaac Asimov kind of science fiction, there's always the young engineer who says, well, how does the broccoli drive work? You know, and then, well, you see, you know, the broccoli has special emanations, special vegetable rays, and we put it in here and it does this and it does that. And that's your excuse to tell the reader, because otherwise you just have an engineer talking you know, without any reason for that. And but I always try to go even beyond that a little bit and find something else in the scene that can be interesting or entertaining or show you something about the character who is receiving the information and maybe the character who is giving the information. So it is not simply an information dump, or as some of my fantasy writing colleagues once used to refer to it, an expository lump, you know, which is just information in a big clunk that you throw down in front of people. So yeah, that's very much the idea, is to make things so the reader is absorbing them without feeling like, oh God, this is like being back in school.
One last thing, maybe, because we are not talking about Last King of Ostenart right now, because it's for us in the far future.
Yes.
I've read it already and I'm in awe. It's just awesome. And we have several listeners who ask, how do you keep track of such a big world? And how do you build such a world? We heard already something about that yesterday too. So maybe keeping track would be really a good choice, because now we know you are writing literally first in your head.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have such a memory that you have everything in your head? Do you have anything to help you?
No, the only kind of real consistent note-taking I do is that I will make an abstract as I go along, which is, you know, the chapter and like a little half a sentence on each of the whatever the point of view sections are. So I might have chapter 25, Simon and Mary talk about X. So-and-so arrives in such and such. Benedict cooks a bunny, you know, or whatever. But so, you know, just, and that is not for going ahead. That is much more that I use when I have to go back and look for something in my first draft, because, you know, oftentimes I'm 700-800 pages in. I do not want to leaf back through the story to try and find something. So I can say, oh, okay, I'll just go look at the abstract and that will tell me. And then I can go and find out, oh no, it wasn't a bunny that Benedict was cooking. It was a squirrel, or, you know, whatever. And, you know, so I don't have to fix everything in the second draft. I also occasionally will make notes, like at night before I fall asleep, I will make a little note on my phone, you know, just saying of something I've just thought of that I don't want to lose before the morning. But the interesting thing is I almost never go back to look at those notes. Just the act of writing them down is usually enough to keep them in my mind, and then they become part of the stuff that I've already thought about and will continue to work with. So yeah, no, I'm not big on notes. It feels much more organic to me to have as much of it in my head as possible, because again, I'm not committed to anything. It's all like, it's like in gaming, you know, where you have sandbox worlds. My sandbox world is in my head. Do you know that expression? Oh, a sandbox world is a world that is not necessarily about doing a certain thing or following a certain path.
Just for fun.
Yeah, you just go around. You can maybe make things, do things, meet people and all that. But they're essentially sandbox like children play in, mm-hmm, and make their castles and stuff. So for me, my sandbox world is in my head. And the more I can keep it up there, the more freedom that I have to try things and change things. So I like to keep it that way and not make notes if I can avoid it. And I was actually making a joke last night, I think, but it's sadly true, which is that now that they're, you know, the manuscripts are all digital, and my old manuscripts are still around in paper, but if somebody ever, you know, was bored enough to want to start a library of the works of Tad Williams, very little stuff that is actually written down. You know, I do not have copious pages of notes of, you know, things in that.
So we will not have a collection of letters by Ted Williams.
Well,
or emails.
There will be a collection of sarcastic postings online that will have to suffice for my thoughts on most things, and a few interviews. But other than that, no, I really, most of it's in my head. Most of my work, if I died in the middle of writing something, I, you know, somebody else could finish it, but it would have nothing to do with what I had planned, because, you know, it's all here and it solidifies as I go along. You know, things slowly move from imagined to real.
But you have I think so. You have a certain point where you want to get your figures to go, your characters, because otherwise you could not tell the story. It's just you have a vague line where the story is going to go, and you just put flesh on it on the go.
It has to be more than just a vague line. I have to have some idea about how I'm going to end things. That doesn't mean I know all the details, and I certainly don't know all the paths that the characters will travel to get to that point. But I have to have some good idea, because I am not, although we often call them, oh, the Dragonbone Chair series or the Witchwood Crown series or the Otherlands series, they're not series books. They are really all of them. Each one is a single individual story that, due to the limitations of binding books, you know, they have to be, and also for me to be able to, you know, continue to feed my family and all that, they have to be broken up into smaller pieces. But so when I was starting the Dragonbone Chair, for instance, I had to know some of the things that were going to happen at the end, so that as if I was writing one single book, I could begin to put in clues and foreshadowing. So I had to know something of what I was doing. But you can never know a story that long and complicated ahead of time in anything like complete detail. So there's a lot that changes along the way too. And that's the most interesting part for me, is that balance between what I expect is going to happen and what I in essence have to work toward, with the keeping it fresh, keeping it interesting, bringing in things that happen, because I'm oftentimes many years on these books. So, you know, I will experience many things, have many new thoughts, have new ideas for characters and settings and things like that.
Inspiration.
Yeah. So you have to have that opening in the story. There has to be enough breathing room to use whatever you are feeling at the time or have learned about your own story. Because as I mentioned, like with Cadrach, no intentions, didn't even know he existed when I first started. Got to that bit with Simon, wanted something going on besides merely Simon getting pickpocketed, and just made up a character who seemed interesting.
And he's such an important character at the end.
Yes, exactly.
So,
but it was
just really interesting to get to know this, even if you know the whole story.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And again, that's the kind of thing I have to stay open for. So even though I'm trying to know a lot of the ending, I also want that breathing room in the story. And it's one of the reasons, to be honest, why my books are so long, because I have these big stories to tell, but then I also leave room to add things, add characters, take side trips.
But you finish your books. That's really great. I have to say so. So it's just...
Thank you. I do pride myself on it, not to the extent of demeaning any other writers who have more problems with that. But part of it is that I have done it many times now. And you it's just like anything. You develop muscles, whether as a writer or any other job that people do or thing that they love creatively and pursue in their lives. The more you do it, the more you move past the how exactly am I going to do this, and you jump to the more creative side right away. You know, after you've done things enough time, you're not sitting there thinking through every single detail. You're saying, I know generally how to do this. I just have to plug in how I want to do it this time. So, yeah, I have now learned that I cannot start ending a book or a story near the ending. I have to start thinking about things even before I reach the middle, because oftentimes I have let I always use the metaphor of the sheep. I have opened the pen and the sheep are all over the field.
And you have to get them back together.
I have to get them all back into that pen again, but it won't happen all at once. It's just me. I have to get them back in. So I have to do them in groups, and I have to start already moving some of them over here so they won't get in the way. And, you know,
such a nice picture. Yeah.
Yeah, and it really feels like that. So I will even be starting in a three or four book series. I will be starting oftentimes in the first or more often the second book to begin to guide these parts back together again. And especially in fantasy novels, because you struggle with the problem of technology. Unless you are writing the kind of magic that allows people to go instantly from one place to the other, you know, or have some kind of winged horse or something. You are dealing with what our ancestors dealt with in the pre-industrial era. And there are no trains, no nothing. And so as a result, if you literally have let your characters stray out or have had to go over, you know, in different directions on little side journeys and things, it will take them time to all get together. And they all have to be find out a reason why they're going there fairly early on.
I think that's one of the problems that George R. R. Martin has to finish his series. Mm. He has too many sheep out of the pen and it's just too widespread, so he cannot gather them together all at once now.
And to be honest, and I deeply respect George as a writer, I think he is a wonderful writer and a good guy. I mean, I like George and his writing long before the first Game of Thrones. And I saw that coming a little bit. I said, you know, I don't think he's going to be able to pull this back together easily because it's difficult without the kind of hand of the author reaching in and being obvious about moving characters quickly or skipping over sections so you can kind of get them from here to there without actually spending time. Whereas to the best of my ability, I really try to keep the pace of character movement similar for all the characters. I mean, obviously there are some really minor characters you don't check in with for a very long time, but most of the main characters I go back to often enough that I don't want one of them having covered a great deal of distance or gone through a great deal of time in their own storyline that is completely out of sync with the others. So both the way I write it and the way the characters move through the story tends to be very much as you finally read it. I move everything forward in small increments. And
that the timelines are very synchronized all the time.
As much as possible.
Sometimes you have the feeling that there is a difference in the time zone.
Yeah.
Especially that you get them together to similar points where you say, oh, now we are in one line and timeline is up to date,
yeah.
Everything's fine, and that's
you don't want to be overly rigorous. You don't want to slow down one timeline just so it will match up with another. You know, sometimes you do go a few days ahead or you stay a few weeks behind even or something. But yeah, the idea is that over the course of the story that it feels more or less like the reader is participating in close to real time, you know, and the same real time as the characters. There are always exceptions, you know, there are weird little bits or flashbacks or whatever. But generally, yeah, I try to write the books in the order they will be read, in part because that makes it easier for me to feel, oh, we haven't looked into this plot line for a while, or we haven't heard from this character for a while. Is there a reason for that, that they need to be kept aside from the main story? Or is that just the fact that I've been telling another thing where I took a lot of work over on this side and now it's time to go back? So that helps me also to write it in the same order that it gets read.
Okay, and just coming back to your words, you have to have a magic system to gather your sheep together. The magic in Austen art is really subtle. Do you want to tell us something about that?
Well,
just when we started the podcast, there is something like a running gag on a podcast about Tolkien's Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
About magic.
Yeah.
Is it magic or not? And Sabrina asked me, do we have magic? And I said, yes, we have it, but it's not just so obvious as in other series. But we have dragons, for example.
Yeah.
Too.
Yeah.
So your magic system is so subtle. And I have the thinking that it's not so easy to learn it, and that using the magic in Austen art comes always with paying a price.
Yeah, well, actually, that's right in the beginning of the story in the Dragonbone Chair, where Morgane says that, speaking of Priorates, that Priorates is one of these people who doesn't just kind of, you know, open the door a crack to look through in terms of dealing with other powers and forces, but he throws the door wide open and lets whatever is out there come in, and that how terribly dangerous that is. So, yeah, and that was another way in which I don't know if whether it was Tolkien himself, because there are other writers who I feel this way about too, but I do believe that unless you are specifically writing a story about magic and magic use, like, say, for instance, A Wizard of Earthsea, which does have a lot to do with how the magical system works, because it's about the training of a wizard and his failure to learn all the lessons properly and his headstrong nature as a young man, or other books. A friend of mine who is very, very dyslexic, named Blake Charlton, wrote a book about that all magic use was linked to words and to reading. And because his main character was dyslexic, he was failing consistently at being a wizard. But he found other ways, as dyslexic people often do. His brain rewired itself to find other pathways. And as a result, he finds another kind of magic. And the book is actually, it's a great pun. The title is Spell Right. And that spell, S-P-E-L-L, like a magical spell, but also like spelling words. Spell Right, W-R-I-G-H-T, which is a maker of things like wheelwright or whatever. But it also has the pun of spell right, spell correctly, which of course dyslexics oftentimes have trouble doing. So that's a book where looking into the magic system in depth makes sense because it's about the magic. But I have always liked books like The Lord of the Rings, like L.P. Boston, L.M. Boston. Anyway, there's a book called The Green Now series, K-N-O-W-E, which are these very sweet, melancholy kind of kids books about a magical house. But it's all super, super subtle, you know, and I love, you know, the things that come to you, either scary stuff or magical stuff, stuff that creeps in psychologically, you know, the idea of, you know, people hurling spells at each other in the sort of, you know, Harry Potter sense is fine if that's what you're working with. But I don't feel it works as well with what I'm trying to do. Magic for me has to have a cost, and a big cost. So there are very few characters who actually can use magic, and some of them are not very responsible, like Priorities. And, you know, that there are reasons for that. This is stuff that, you know, it would be dangerous if anybody could do it, if you could just pick up a wand and say, you know, Expelliarmus or whatever. And, you know, that's, you have to know and have to have paid a price to be able to use those kinds of powers. And you don't, I mean, I don't think, for instance, that Morganes, we see any example of Morganes doing anything like that, except in the subtlest possible ways that things are kind of happening out of the corner of Simon's eye, that he kind of goes, was that there? Was that, you know, until he's literally trying to protect Simon from death in, you know, the chapter 12, I think that is, of where things start to blow up in the Dragonbone chair. So, yeah, I definitely am somebody who would rather underuse magic and keep it mysterious than make it a forefront of the story, because that raises all these other questions. You know, why don't they just use magic all the time? Why don't they just do this? Why don't they, you know, the stuff you hear about the Lord of the Rings, why don't the eagles just fly Sam and Frodo to Mordor? And, you know, that's not what I'm interested in. I'm interested in characters who are basically living like we would be living if we were there, and having to overcome the problems that are difficult for humans. And that includes things like distance and fighting somebody bigger than you, and, you know, the very real stuff from the real world.
What is this world feeling? You spend so much time in this world, in Austin Art or in other land. What is this world feeling to end this? Is it difficult? Is it like losing someone?
Not really, because and you will often hear me making this analogy, but your listeners may not have heard it. If they're lucky, they haven't had to hear me blab on about it. But I often use what I call the tennis ball analogy. I have a dog right now who is, the first time in years, I have a tennis ball dog, and she just wants to play ball forever. I mean, she would play until I fell over dead, and then she would probably still nudge me like, why aren't you throwing that ball? So when I used to have my first tennis ball dog, I found out very quickly that there is, if you throw the ball and it bounces and goes into the bushes where the dog can't get it, and the dog is sitting there, you know, trying to figure out, well, where did it go? Where is it? And you pick up another ball and go, look, ball. In my experience, the dog does not care about the new ball because that ball is not alive. It is not the ball that has been bouncing that you threw, right? That's what they care about. And the new ball is nothing. Maybe if you throw it, then you can now make it the live ball, but it's always the live, slobbery ball that they want most. And for me, whatever book or story I am currently working on is the living, slobbery tennis ball. And therefore, even though I may have a deep and complex relationship with the characters of a story I've just finished, when I am finished, it is much like upstairs neighbors have moved out and some other neighbors have moved in. And while on the one hand, I may say, I really like those old neighbors. You know, we had some really good times together. You know, oh, I remember the music they played and when they would have parties and, you know, things like that. But they're not there anymore. And so my feelings for them are different than my feelings for the neighbors who are there now, who I am now actively engaged with on an everyday basis. So it is always the story I'm working on that is the living thing for me. And it's not that I don't care about the other stories, but there is a vast difference for me anyway, maybe for all writers, between what we are currently thinking about, which takes up so much of our mind and attention, versus something we have finished, which is now in the thank God that's done. Which doesn't mean we didn't love working on it. You have to love it when you're working on it, especially a very long project. But it does mean that once it's finished, it's not alive anymore. It has moved into the next realm. And this is one of the reasons why I could go 30 years before coming back to Oostenaarde. I was not pining for Oostenaarde. I was not pining to go back to Simon or Miriamelle or Binnebik or Isgrimner or any of these characters. Much as I enjoyed them, I was doing other things. And each of those sequentially became the most important thing, the slobber and dirt-covered tennis ball. And so right now, after I finished what I'm working on now and wrote a couple of other things, and now I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to work on next, and everything that I just wrote, you know, I literally finished the first draft of one of my new books the day before I got on the plane to Germany, even though I will still be working on it in a sense of editing it and polishing it and all that, it's already begun to move out of my consciousness because I won't be doing the kind of original thinking that is the most important and entertaining part of the process. So yeah, we have very little loyalty, we writers, to at least me. I don't miss them in that sense. I'm just like, they were part of my life for a while and it was good fun. And now I've got these new people and things that I have to work with. And that's what I want to do, is always be making a new story.
And a new tennis ball.
And a new tennis ball, yes.
I hope our listeners will enjoy this, because it was very interesting to see your point of view and your creative work. Thank you so much that you joined us for this episode. And yeah. It was a pleasure for me, I think for Sabrina, oh, too. And thank you. Nothing left. It's just, we're in awe. It's just so interesting. And you're such a nice person. And thank you so much.
Well, I'm glad I fooled you. And because I'm really a horrible, horrible person.
No.
But I have to tell you that, you know, the idea that people actually are as interested in this stuff as I am when I'm doing it is lovely. And that is exactly what I have always hoped when I was working, that kind of detail and interest in this, because I do, I put a lot of thought into these things. And you sometimes wonder, will anyone ever even notice this, you know? And so when people do notice it, it is, you know, very much a heart melting moment.
That would be the last question. What are you thinking that there are a person who made a podcast out of your books?
Exactly that. I am delighted. I really do put a great deal of thought into this. I have always been a creative person. I have done many things besides writing. I played in a band. I did radio. I did theater. I drew, was a professional artist for a while and did cartooning and other kinds of commercial art. And so I have a lot of different things that are in me that motivate me. And writing so far has been the one that comes closest to doing all those things. But I do put a huge amount of myself into my work and the things that I love and the things that I'm interested in. So it's a huge validation when people actually are really interested in how these things are put together and they enjoy the results and want to know details about how I do it, because it's my life, you know, that's what I do. So thank you for caring.
It was and is and will be a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. That now, after this build-up, it had better be really, really good.
Yes, of course.
Just by the moment, you know, the pressure is mounting, building.
Okay, yes.
That's good.
Yeah, that's awesome.